This is Don Sneen. The topic is The Messiahs of Israel. The date is December 13th, 1990. In what is called the Little Apocalypse of Mark 13, we read these words of Jesus. If anyone says to you, "Look, here is the Christ," or "Look, there he is," do not believe it. False Christs and false prophets will arise and show signs and wonders to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. But take heed, I have told you all things beforehand. Jesus was warning his disciples about these false Christs and false prophets. It seemed like some were preaching at that very time, functioning in Galilee and Judea, and others would come in the future. Today, the big difference, I would say the great divide between Christianity and Judaism, is this phrase, "Jesus is the Messiah," or "Jesus is the Christ." The influential Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, who was an admirer of Jesus and promoted relations between Jews and Christians, stated it this way, and I quote, "To the Christian, the Jew is the incomprehensibly stubborn man who declines to see what has happened, namely that the Messiah has come. And to the Jew, the Christian is the incomprehensibly daring man who affirms in an unredeemed world that its redemption has been accomplished." The term Messiah means the Anointed One. The Anointed One who was to rule, the Anointed One as King that was to rule. It's exactly equivalent to Christ. Messiah being the Hebrew term and Christ the Greek term. The term was increasingly reserved after King David for an ideal king who would come in the future, who would be, as it were, a second David and would establish a kind of golden age. He would come in David's line and he would bring in the glorious reign the Jews nostalgically associated with King David. After all, King David, roughly 1,000 years before Christ, had put Israel, as it were, on the map, and it had become a world power. Now, let's look at this from the standpoint, our topic from the standpoint of four things. First of all, let's note evidence from the Hebrew Bible, from the Old Testament, as we call it, in which the two faiths are in agreement on the idea of a Messiah. After all, our idea of a Messiah originates from the Old Testament, from the history of the Jews. So let's look at some passages here, surely not all of them, there are many more, but some very important passages in this respect. From Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2, and also verses 6 and 7.
"The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shined. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this."
And then from Isaiah 11, verses 1 to 9, another great messianic passage.
"A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and the Spirit of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and power, the Spirit of knowledge, the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees within his eyes, or decide by what he hears with his ears. But with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give dissension for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with a rod of his mouth, with his breath, with his, and of his lips will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the slash around his waist. The wolf will lie with the lamb, and the leopard will lie with the goat, the calf and the lion, and the yearling together. The little child will lead them. The cow will feed the bear, and the young will lie together. And the lion will eat straw with the ox. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child puts his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountains of the Lord of the earth. Will be faithful, will be full of the knowledge of the Lord, and the waters will cover the sea.
All right. There's a great future, isn't there, that's coming here. Notice, of course, some of these tremendous names or terms that are ascribed to this one who is to come. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Notice the origins from David, the ideal king, coming, well, out of Jesse's line. Jesse, of course, an ancestor of David here. Note also that this future ruler will be charismatic, will have, as it were, gifts of the Spirit. Six are listed there in Isaiah 11. Wisdom, understanding, counsel, might, knowledge, fear of the Lord. He's going to exercise all of these gifts of the Spirit. This Messiah will be a charismatic person. And then notice in the concluding verses of that great oracle from Isaiah 11 that the reign of the Messianic King will be, as it were, a paradise restored, in which the disorders of nature are going to be replaced by a harmony, a pristine harmony, if you will. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb. The leopard lie down with the kid. The calf and the lion will be together. A little child shall lead them, and so on. This is paradise. It's also nice, isn't it? No wonder that the Jew, looking at the world as it now is, with all our wars and alienation and disturbances and chaotic situations and suffering, turns to the Christian and says, "How can you believe? How can you believe that the Messiah has really come?" Now, Psalm 2 is an interesting psalm. It's been regarded as a coronation hymn, and it may well have been composed and used for the ceremony in which kings of Israel were anointed. And these, of course, were big events, grandiose events. Let's hear Psalm 2.
Why do the nations conspire, and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and his anointed, saying, "Let us burst their bonds asunder and cast their cords from us." He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord has them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, "I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron, and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore, O kings, be wise, be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear, with trembling kiss his feet, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him."
Yes, notice here, of course, again the role of the king, but particularly notice that line, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." And these words express the conviction that God, as it were, adopted the king of Israel as his son at the moment of that anointing. Something was taking place here. The king was really now God's agent here upon earth and was to exercise as such. The king now attained the honorary status of divine sonship with all of the privileges that went with it. And God would give to the king victory over the enemies, the rulers of the earth. And note, An additional feature, it would be interpreted by the overwhelming majority of Jews in temporal terms, in political terms. The Messiah, or the Anointed One, the King, would be a human being in a unique status with God, who would give, God would give this earthly ruler victory over the enemy nations, the enemy rulers. There's another passage, but this is an odd one because it refers to a non-Israelite. And it shows something, I guess, of the breadth of the idea here. From Isaiah 45, verse 1.
Thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have grasped, to subdue nations before him and ungird the loins of kings, to open doors before him that gates may not be closed.
Yes, and who after all is Cyrus?
Persian.
Cyrus the Persian. He's not a Jew. But he's going to help God. He's going to assist the Lord in accomplishing a divine mission, just as Isaiah almost two centuries earlier had viewed the powerful Assyrians as the rod of the Lord's anger. That is God's instrument for punishing Israel. Now it's going to be the reverse, as it were. Now, the Isaiah of the exile sees Cyrus as the staff of the Lord's blessing. So he calls Cyrus God's Anointed One, as it were, God's Messiah. Now, applying that term, Messiah, to a non-Hebrew then shows something of the flexibility of the use of the term, as well as reinforcing the idea that the expected ruler would be a king of this world, a temporal king. So in a general sense, and this is most significant, I think, the prophet is proclaiming that the God of Israel is the Lord of history, who can even use a pagan king to accomplish the divine purpose. Secondly, let's turn to some Jewish apocryphal and intertestamental writings. Not in our Bible, but significant, I think, for understanding what comes to make up, as it were, the mentality of the people of Jesus' time when he did come. And I'm drawing upon some from the two centuries just before Christ and also from the first century of the Christian era. There are a lot of these writings, and I'm only selecting some limited ones here. But nevertheless, from these sources, I think you'll get an idea of the wide range of views concerning the Messiah in Judaism. The party that's in some ways the most interesting of the different parties in Judaism, whether it's the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Zealots, and the Essenes, the one that's the most interesting is the Essenes in many ways. And I think their views of the Messiah were the most developed. Now, we knew about them before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, but since the discovery of those Dead Sea Scrolls down there by the Dead Sea at Qumran, we know some other things that we did not know before, especially from some of the sources there. That Qumran community, which was one of the several Essene communities, existed from about 140 BC until it was destroyed by the Romans, we were almost sure, in 68 AD. A very strange community. It really has no parallel in Jewish history. It had a very priestly hierarchy. They had to stay up. Okay, if you were a member of the Qumran community, you were expected to stay up every third night and study scripture, the Torah and other scriptures, but always a priest had to be present. And a priest always said the blessing at meals, both before meals and after meals. Verlon, you would be a busy person there. It was very legalistic, even more so than the Pharisees. The Pharisees made allowance, and they had scriptural basis for this. They made allowance for pulling, let's say, an animal that had fallen into a pit or a ditch on the Sabbath. You could pull that creature out, even though it was the Sabbath day. But the Essenes, no. Let the creature stay there. Don't tamper with that on the Sabbath and break the Sabbath. Purification rites. Oh my. They were always purifying themselves so that they would be pure. In fact, even before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the historian Otto von Harnack said about the Essenes, and I quote, "The Essenes were always in the bathtub." they were just very concerned about cleanliness. They were very apocalyptic. The time is short. The new age is coming. Prepare for it. And the way that you do it, well, let's hear from Isaiah 40, verse 1. And this, incidentally, is, I think, the most quoted verse in their writings. You find it again and again.
"Comfort, comfort my people, says your God."
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. Isaiah 40, verse 1. Go on. I should admit. Just go on until I stop you.
"Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice cries, in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God."
Okay, that's the one that especially is quoted a great deal. Granted, they spoke about comfort also in their community, but in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. And the way they were going to do it was to have a pure community out there by studying the Torah, by studying the scriptures, but especially the Torah of the Old Testament scriptures, and enforcing it, living it. They were going to prepare the way of the Lord. Now, they believed, coming back to their view of the Messiah, we have to put it in the plural, they seemed to believe in two Messiahs. But this Messiah, or these Messiahs, would be preceded by a prophetic forerunner. Reading directly from the Manual of Discipline, and I quote, "Until the coming of the prophet and of both the priestly and the lay Messiah, these men are not to depart from the clear intent of the law to walk in any way in the stubbornness of their own hearts." And there are also references to these figures in the Damascus document, another one of their documents. Now let's just walk through these three different figures here. The prophet is going to come first of all before either of these messiahs. The prophet will come in the last days, and this prophet will fulfill Deuteronomy 18:18, that originally was, of course, spoken to Moses. "I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brethren, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that which I command him." Now, in the New Testament, this figure is John the Baptist. And this Isaiah 40 passage is quoted in all of the Synoptic Gospels with reference to John the Baptist. The next figure, who is really the first Messiah, was the anointed priest, the Messiah of Aaron. Now, remember what I said about the very, very exalted role that the priests had. They were very priestly oriented. This anointed Messiah would be the primary figure in the New Age. And as such, and this is very significant, he was superior to the lay Messiah. Just as the priests were always over the laity within the community itself. There's another writing which we don't believe came from Qumran, but which nevertheless has been found there, copies of it have been found there, called the Book of the 12 Patriarchs. That also comes from the intertestamental period. And in some of the writings there, at least two places, you have Judah. Judah, the main tribe, leader of the main tribe. But Judah bows down to Levi, the priest. I think that's very significant. Judah bows down to Levi. Levi's the priest has become superior. So the priest is the head honcho, as it were, of this whole operation, or the priests are the leaders. The third figure, the second Messiah then, the royal Messiah, the lay Messiah, will be the leader of the new Israel and commander of the armies. In the final war, He is the one who will lead them in the fight against the armies of these pagan nations, these godless nations such as Edom and Moab and Gog and Magog and so on. And he will be the political leader, the military leader, and bear the sword and lead the armies of the righteous, defeating the earthly powers of darkness and wickedness. But the priests are going to have a part too. They're going to be the cheerleaders, as it were, carrying the banners, you know, and in this holy war of the sons of light against the sons of darkness. Well, when we look at some of the other writings, it's kind of a confusing array. By other writings, I mean these intertestamental and apocryphal writings. Kind of a confusing array here of views about the Messiah. And you can't really get a systematic picture of the Messiah from these sources, but I'll give a few examples. There's a book called the Book of Enoch. Now, Enoch, remember, was this fellow that was, well, transported up into heaven. And in this strange book of Enoch, he's as it were, touring around up in heaven. He's being led around in a heavenly tour. But also there's some stuff about the Messiah, and that's what we're going to take a couple examples of. From one of the books there, called the Book of the Dream Visions. Actually, the Book of Enoch is five different books under one title. But the Dream Visions, you have a whole history of Israel. In fact, a history going back to creation and up to the time of Judas Maccabeus. The other night we celebrated Hanukkah, and that's the time of Judas Maccabeus, 168 B.C. And the way they tell this history is very, very colorful. It's symbolic imagery. For example, the various characters are presented as animals. That's a feature of apocalyptic. Human beings are portrayed as animals here. It's kind of a code language, you see, but very symbolic. The beasts and birds of prey are the heathen oppressors who pick away on the sheep. The sheep are the faithful Israelites. And a sheep with a great horn, the wicked beasts pick on, but they can't conquer, is this Judas Maccabeus. But the Messiah is a white bull with great horns. And in the end period, they're looking for the Messiah to come, you know, in this struggle, this guerrilla warfare that they're waging. The Messiah is going to come pretty soon. In this end period, the heathen will assault the faithful Jews, just as Antiochus Epiphanes did, but he's going to be defeated. The heathen will be defeated and swallowed up by the earth. The new Jerusalem will be established, surviving Gentiles converted, the righteous dead will be raised, the messianic kingdom will be founded, and then the Messiah will appear.
Could you repeat that?
Yeah. All of this is going to happen, you see, according to the dream visions here. They are really dreaming. The heathen are going to come and assault the faithful Jews, those fighters with Mattathias and his sons, the Maccabees. But they're going to be defeated and swallowed up by the earth. The New Jerusalem will be established, surviving Gentiles converted. They even looked for the conversion of the Gentiles. At Qumran they didn't, by the way. We can discuss some of this, you know, as you, if you want to, after we get done here too. The righteous dead are going to be raised and rewarded. They even believe in a resurrection. And the wicked men and fallen angels are judged and punished, and then a messianic kingdom is going to be founded, and the Messiah will appear then. All of this. So some great things are about to happen. Well, we won't go into that right now, but it didn't quite work out that way, did it? Then there's another book that has really, you know, since we found out the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's even more puzzling in some ways because they didn't find this portion of the Book of Enoch down there. But they found all the other parts. But another part of the Book of Enoch, chapters 37 to 71, the Messiah, or the Elect One, is called the Son of Man. That rings a bell, doesn't it? Son of Man. In the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, 81 times Jesus is addressed as Son of Man. Correction, correct me on this. 81 times Jesus uses the phrase Son of Man, and I think he's using it of himself. He's never once addressed as Son of Man by anyone in the Synoptic Gospels. But here, the elect one or the Messiah, the Son of Man, does not seem to be a human being in the normal sense. Rather, he's a pre-existent heavenly being who sits on a throne and pronounces judgment on all men and angels. Just as in Matthew 25, you know, Jesus says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he'll sit upon his throne and divide the sheep from the goats and so on. Well, here in Enoch, Book of Enoch, chapters 37 to 71, more than a dozen times we encounter this business about the Son of Man, the Elect One, the Messiah, doing this judgment, as it were. And we're not sure just when that was written. Surely in these centuries, but we're not sure whether it was 1st century B.C., 1st century A.D., or just when. Psalms of Solomon, from about 70 A.D. Don't confuse it with the Book of Psalms. It's about 70 A.D. And of course, what occurred in 70 A.D.?
The destruction of the temple.
Terrible year. Absolutely terrible year. It comes from this time. But it talks about a Messiah who is Son of David and King, who will come and purge Jerusalem of the heathen, destroy the godless, and he will establish a realm of holy people. But strangers aren't admitted. But the subjugated Gentiles are going to come from afar and see the glory of God in Jerusalem. And this Messiah will be a just, wise, and powerful king who will introduce a new and blessed age. And this is, I would say, clearly a nationalistic and very military view of the Messiah. Then there's another book, and this one we do have in the Apocrypha. From about 90 A.D., it's later. And it's kind of a blending of earthly messianic hopes and a transcendent Messiah, Messiah in the heavens. And this book is called Second Esdras. And in chapter 5, the writer, whoever it is, some very devout Jew, starts talking about the signs that precede the coming of the Messiah. And again, it's very idyllic, very imaginative, very picturesque. But then finally we get to the passage about the Messiah himself in the Second Esdras, chapter 7, verses 27 to 30. And I'll read that, quoting it directly. Everyone who has been delivered from the evils that I have foretold shall see my wonders, for my son the Messiah shall be revealed with those who are with him, and those who remain shall rejoice 400 years. After those years, my son the Messiah shall die, and all who draw human breath. Then the world shall be turned back to primeval silence for 7 days, as it was in the first beginning, so that no one shall be left. And then it goes on to describe the judgment that will follow. The Messiah is going to come. There'll be a messianic age lasting 400 years. Then Messiah will die and will go back into some primeval, chaotic period of judgment. There's some other accounts, and it's very, you know, I'd say there are these numerous ones, that have a messianic reign of 40 years. And then, of course, there's also the 1,000 years in some accounts. Well, as you can see, it's very complex, and I've just touched some of the surface here with a few examples. Let's go on thirdly to some actual messianic movements. Remember, of course, Jesus in Mark 13 in the parallels saying false Christs, false messiahs, false prophets are going to come. And they're going to, maybe some are already there, and they're going to gather around, you know, the messianic banquet table like a bunch of flies around the picnic table in summertime. That kind of thing. He's warning the disciples. Well, when we come to the time of Christ, and, you know, within a century after, we encounter some very interesting false messiahs. I'm going to mention about four of them here. Four personalities who made messianic claims for themselves. Now, here's where the messianic fever, up to 104 or whatever, really rises. There was in 6 AD an uprising in Palestine led by Judas the Galilean. And that's the origin of the party of the Zealots. Incidentally, the Essenes, strangely enough, are not mentioned in the New Testament specifically. We think that they're referring to them several times, but they're not mentioned specifically. But the Zealots, they are. And after this, really, throughout the rest of the century and into the second century even, Palestine was a hotbed of tumults and seditions and pretenders of all kinds. Rome, of course, was in control, and the messiahs here were for the most part real messianic leaders that were warriors against this kind of control. Well, some of these leaders. One of them was a certain man by the name of Theudas. And he's mentioned in Acts 5:36, but it's kind of confusing. He's also mentioned in Josephus. According to Josephus, this Theudas gathered a group of followers and promised to part the waters of the Jordan River and lead them over to the other side. That's the way he'd show that he had divine power. After all, if you can part the waters, you know. Remember what Herod's song in Jesus Christ Superstar? Prove to me that you're no fool, walk across my swimming pool, mm-hmm. Prove to me that you're divine, turn my water into wine. Well, mm-hmm. This Messiah was going to have, pseudo-Messiah had claimed a lot of powers here. He'd do signs. Well, it didn't work out that way because the Roman proconsul Cuspius, this is 44 AD, after Pontius Pilate, not long after though, captured him and cut his head off and took his head up to Jerusalem and put it on public display. That's a pretty heavy deterrent, you know, to those that would claim to be messiahs. Now, there's a reference in Acts 5:36 by Gamaliel to a Theudas, but it's confusing because his speech seems to have been made some years before the uprising in 44 AD. Maybe there were two with this name. We don't know. Two Theudai. Put the plural on it. Another messianic pretender who's mentioned in Acts 21:38 and also in Josephus was simply called the Egyptian. In Acts 21, Paul was rescued from a Jewish mob in Jerusalem that wanted to lynch him, rescued by Roman soldiers, but they in turn start beating Paul up. But he then proceeds to speak to the Roman officer, tribune, in Greek. And this, of course, startles the Roman officer, who says, "Do you know Greek? Are you not the Egyptian who recently stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?" Well, in the years just before this, sometime in the 50s AD, there'd been that revolt led by the Egyptian. And Josephus gives an account of this, only he has 30,000 men. Josephus, I think, is given to a little exaggeration now and then. But at any rate, Josephus says that this fellow was a cheat, a false prophet, and Josephus says that he assembled 30,000 followers, led them from the wilderness to the Mount of Olives, intending to conquer Jerusalem. But he was met by Roman soldiers on the way, who broke up the rebellion, captured and killed quite a few of these followers of this Messiah, pseudo-Messiah, and what did the Egyptian do? But he ran away. He's hardly a hero, is he? And this took place, according to Josephus, when Felix was procurator of Judea between 53 and 60 AD. This in Josephus, The Wars of the Jews. And there's also a mention in the Antiquities, and I didn't bring my copy of Josephus along, and so I couldn't check the Antiquities on this one. But there was another hothead who gathered a band of Jews and marched around the walls of Jerusalem 7 times, thinking that the walls would fall down, you know, but they didn't. It was nothing like Joshua marching around Jericho, you know, because with this hothead here, this messianic pretender, the walls continued standing and nothing really happened. Well, the Roman-Jewish war started by the Zealots in 66 AD ended, of course, with crushing defeat. We've noticed that, the destruction of Jerusalem and of the temple. But the Jews were a very stubborn people, a very resilient people also, and spurred on by some messianic hope, Jews elsewhere, diaspora Jews, in Mesopotamia, Cyprus, Egypt, Cyrene, revolted during the reign of the Roman Emperor Trajan, 98 to 117. And it was put down with excessive cruelty and heavy loss of life. What really motivated it was this messianic hope, even though it didn't seem to center so much on one specific personality like some of these other instances did. Well, about a generation after this, a second Jewish revolt broke out in Palestine. The first one, of course, being that 66 to 70 war of the Jews and the Romans. But in 132 AD, a revolt led by Simon Bar Kokhba broke out. And he was regarded by multitudes of Jews as the Messiah. Do you have Numbers 24:17 ready? Because he is viewed as the one who fulfills this, what they viewed as a messianic prediction.
I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not now. 9. A star shall come forth out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Sheth.
Okay, a star shall come forth out of Jacob, and a scepter shall arise out of Israel. He gets the name Simon, well, that's his first name, but he's Bar Kokhba, the son of the star. Kokhba, the Hebrew for the word star. And mind you, even the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, Rabbi Akiva, or sometimes pronounced Akiba, but Rabbi Akiva, the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, I suppose the leading religious figure in Palestine at the time, by this time a very, very old man, in his 90s, lived to a very, very ripe old age, and had been a leader for decades in Palestinian Judaism that was not stamped out even in 70 AD. This rabbi hailed Bar Kokhba as Messiah. I think that's very, very interesting. Now, we've found lots of, archaeologists, have found lots of evidence from this period. A lot of it has turned up in the last, generation or so. Coins from this war, letters, and so on, have been found. Bar Kokhba took Roman coins and overstamped them with his own markings. The silver denarius had a wreath and the word Simon on the front, and a jug and palm with words, Year 2 of the Liberty of Israel, on the back. In other words, a new age had started here. See? Year 1, 132, year 2, 133, and so on. I'm using the Christian way of reckoning it, but they'd started a new age. Year 1, year 2, year 3. Simon was described as Prince of Israel on some of the other coins. A contract written in Aramaic was dated in the third year of the liberation of Israel by the hand of Simon ben Kokhba. Other coins were struck that referred to the year of redemption. But you see, it didn't turn out to be redemption, but disaster at the hands of the Roman army in 135 AD. Bar Kokhba was killed, and Rabbi Akiva, or Akiba, take your choice, who was in his mid-90s, was tortured and finally martyred, dying with the words of the Shema, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, on his lips. He is to this day among devout Jews regarded as one of the great martyrs of the history of the Jews. Jews were absolutely, from now on, after 135, were absolutely excluded from Jerusalem. The city was renamed Ilia Capitolina, and a temple to the Roman god Jupiter was built where the temple of Yahweh had once stood. And this was adding insult to injury. It was pouring the wound in, pouring the salt in the wound and rubbing it in. One more, but this is centuries later, and this is a fascinating one too. In the 17th century, another messianic movement emerged among the Jews. And the figure here was a certain Shabbatai Zevi, who lived from 1626 to 1676. He was born in Izmir, Turkey, which is ancient Smyrna in the book of Revelation. A big city today. I think the Sixth Fleet, among others, operates out of there. And like most messianic movements, it was very apocalyptic. The end had come, you see, or was coming. But it was peaceful. But Shabbatai had a vision here and an aim of establishing the new Zion in the biblical land of Palestine. And again, multitudes of Jews, thousands and thousands of them, caught the messianic fever, and Shabbateanism as a movement lasted for several decades, long after Shabbatai Zevi himself had died. I think it lasted for well over 100 years after his death, even. Well, finally, a few comments and a couple of quotes by way of summary. It's hard to summarize all of this, you see, but it's very general, but a few comments by way of summary. Most of the ideas and the movements and the personalities were political and nationalistic in nature and aim. But we saw some exceptions among the Essenes, especially among the Essenes. And of course, the big exception is Jesus of Nazareth, or Yeshua of Nazareth. In a few cases, there were those who believed in a Messiah who suffers. But oddly enough, Isaiah 53 did not become a part of Jewish messianic thinking. To Christians, yes, but not to Jews, even to this day. There's also, talk of a hidden Messiah, hinted at a couple places in the Gospel of John. I may say something about that Saturday morning, because I've got a whole lecture written on that, which I wrote that I've never given.
Now's your chance.
Yeah. And there are also some references, especially in the book of Enoch, to a Messiah who dies. We noticed one of those. And there are some elsewhere, too. But, get this, there is no evidence in all of the Jewish literature to a belief in a Messiah who suffers and dies. I'll repeat that. There is no evidence in all of the Jewish literature to a belief in a Messiah who suffers and dies. And furthermore, a Messiah who suffers and dies as a substitute for the sins of the human race, for your sins and mine, in the New Testament sense, was unknown in Judaism. So this great divide between synagogue and church that I mentioned in the beginning of this talk continues to be a reality. And in the state of Israel today, there are all kinds of Jews, Orthodox, conservative, some Reform, and a lot of secular Jews as well. Even atheist Jews are considered to be Jews as long as their mother is Jewish. But a Jew who confesses Yeshua is Messiah, is the Messiah, Yeshua is the Messiah, is not regarded as a Jew, but as a Christian, one who's left the faith of the ancestors. And it's one of the ironies in modern Israel. Or is it an irony? Now we can talk about this. And yet there's a renewed interest in Jesus among many Jews today. They're writing books about him. They hail him, sometimes, usually in a very positive sense, as a prophet, as a teacher, Martin Buber is one example. There are others as well. I'm going to give a couple quotes here in closing. And there may well be some among them who are secret believers. Perhaps the time will come when more among them will grapple seriously with the question of Yeshua as the Messiah, or Yeshua as the Christ. And here's a quote from a certain scholar among them, Sholem Ben Koren, who states really a challenge to his own Jewish people this way, and I quote, "What begins with Jesus from Nazareth is the only messianic movement in Judaism that was not an episodical movement, and we can continue these famous words of Gamaliel in Acts. If this came from God, you cannot stop it." It was not stopped, and so it is a challenge to our Jewish existence. We as Jews have to realize that what has happened with the movement of Jesus and his followers is not one of those 30 messianic movements in Judaism, 30, which were like this kakayan plant of the book of Jonah, which lasted only one night and was forgotten the next morning, unquote. One more quote, and then we'll throw this open for any comments, questions, which I maybe can't answer, but we can talk about it. This from another Jew, Hans J. Scheps, who has a very scholarly book on the Apostle Paul. And there are some Jews that are finally studying Paul also. And he writes this. He's summarizing the difference in the affinity between Judaism and Christianity in these words, and I quote, "The messianism of Israel is directed towards that which is to come, while the eschatology of the universal Christian church looks for a return of him who has come. Both are united in the common expectation that the decisive event is still to come, that event which will disclose the consummation of God's ways with men, already partially and differently manifested in his dealings with Israel and the church. The church of Jesus Christ has kept no picture of its Savior and Lord, but it might well be that he who comes at the end of time, he who has been alike the expectations of the synagogue and the church, will bear one and the same countenance," unquote. I let that stand as a conclusion. Now, any comments that you want to make? I suppose this depends on the school. You know, if you're asking about the public schools, of course they study the history of Israel, and maybe, well, surely they study about the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD, and I'm sure they study the Bar Kokhba war. Because he's, and of course Masada is a big deal. I would suspect that Bar Kokhba, of the ones that I mentioned here, is the one that probably still gets quite a bit of mileage and surely the Rabbi Akiva, or Rabbi Akiva as I prefer to say. I guess Akiva is more correct. I think some of these do, but others again I have just, Josephus is our big source here. And you know, it's a funny thing about this Josephus, because in the war of the Jews and the Romans in 66 to 70, if you want to extend it to Masada, 73, Josephus, who had been a general up there in Galilee, went over to the enemy. He surrendered and went over to the enemy and eventually spent his last years in Rome on a nice pension. And lived out really a comfortable life, but he wrote these big histories, you know, the Antiquities of the Jews and the War of the Jews. And had he not done this, all kinds of stuff here would have been lost. And it turns out that Josephus, of course, yeah, he exaggerates in some ways, but in other ways, especially on this business of Masada, he writes about that and gives some details about it, including describing the hill or mountain of Masada. It turns out, you know, the archaeology shows that he was correct in his description. he was poo-pooed, but it turns out that he's not as sloppy a historian as sometimes he's been thought by critics. Yeah.
Well, one of the areas of confusion that I think a lot of us struggle with is that those phrases that indicate that the Messiah will in fact be literally the Son of God, that is, he will be God.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that's really not, that's our interpretation of the words from the Old Testament, which was not the Jewish understanding at all, apparently. I mean, you know, again, like the Shema, where it's the Lord is one, and the concept of the Messiah being literally God,
mm-hmm.
having come to earth, that's quite foreign to their thinking, isn't it? I mean, that's the Trinity, the Trinitarian theology is something that we've more or less developed as Christians. It would not fit in at all, I don't think, with the Jewish understanding of God.
Yeah, they had problems with this, you know. And there was this group known as the Ebionites, who were believers in Jesus as the Messiah, but they rejected his divinity.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this, I guess you'd say, really very conservative branch of Christianity that eventually fizzled out. And of course, some of the church fathers of the second century, third century, and so on, write against the Ebionites. It's a heresy that is rejected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they don't. That's a stumbling block also,
mm-hmm.
to them.
And we look on these things as being so clear. I mean, with hindsight, we look back and say, well, why couldn't they understand?
Yeah.
Here Jesus fulfills this, 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 and this. But as you said, they were looking for something completely different, and many people fulfill those things. If you're born in the right place and you got the right ancestor and you come across as a charismatic leader, you may well have been a Messiah, ultimately perhaps to be proven to be the Messiah. The wonder is that our faith in Christ has lasted so long.
Yeah. Of course, we look at it from the standpoint of the, well, in our mm-hmm. confessions, especially the Nicene Creed. We look at it from a different vantage point here,
yeah.
from the confessional position of Nicaea, as well as the Apostles' Creed in a way, but even more so the Nicene Creed, affirming the, in no uncertain terms, you know, that he's truly human,
divine.
Truly divine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one being with the Father.
Mm-hmm. And whether we should, and this would be, you know, very controversial, and Craig, you may have some observations on this, or Berlin, you may have some, whether we should insist of Jews who say Jesus is the Messiah, that they subscribe to the Nicene Creed, prove their orthodoxy, that they are really believers. I think that's something that would be a big question in my mind. I don't know.
Of course, then we could say, do all Christians subscribe to the Athanasian Creed, which says, if you do not believe this, you will surely perish.
Yeah.
It's like,
Well, yeah, that's one that we, in our confessions, we, you know, our statements, in our church constitutions, we have that, but we never use it.
Is there any connection between the Sabbatinism that you said arose in the 17th century and lasted for a century, that would make it last into the 18th century, that is the 1700s.
Yeah.
Is there any connection with that and Zionism that arises in the 19th century, 100 years later?
I'm not sure. I mean, suspect that...
what you said sounded like it was a prototype of Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
With the desire to return to Palestine?
Yeah. I suspect if there is a connection, it's not that tangible. The idea, I think, is kind of like a seed that does germinate, but it takes a little different form.
You said Sabbatai envisioned a new Zion in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
That's what made me think of Zionism, which arises in the 1800s.
Yeah.
Where did he live? Was he?
He was born in Izmir, as I said, and
Smyrna and so on. So he's a Turk.
Born in the Ottoman Empire in Turkey. I think he also spent some time in Europe. I didn't have opportunity to trace this in the Encyclopedia Judaica after I came here, which has a rather long article on him. And he also spent some time in Palestine. He traveled around some.
How widespread was that movement? I mean, did it affect Jewish populations in Europe, for instance? Were they swept up in this movement, or was it?
Yeah, I wish I could answer your question more exactly. The article that I referred to, well, of course, it has an article on Sabbatai Zvi himself, and then also an article in the same volume on Sabbateanism. It really was very widespread and apocalyptic, messianic, and was, I think, both in Asia and up in some regions in Europe. It's a marvel that it lasted so long, because he died in 1676. But I suppose that shows something of the power of the movement. After all, remember, well, this would be a parallel, but in a way, or at least an analogy, John the Baptist was regarded as the Messiah by a lot of people. And well after his death, there were Baptist sects that viewed John the Baptist as the Messiah.
Although he never did the kingly role.
No.
He never came as the conqueror.
Yeah.
Chaim Potok mentioned somebody, and I don't know if it's this Shabbat or if it was somebody else, that a more recent messianic figure that had a tremendous following and ultimately under threat of death converted to Christianity and lived out his life in Russia. I mean, died in Russia on some kind of a pension and things in Russia, and yet he, you know, he's very modern, but was still had this big following that just couldn't believe that he had actually converted to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
It's got to be a real struggle for the Jews. I mean,
do you recall book
I've
that
got
is
the
in?
Book. It's in Wanderings.
Oh, it's in Wanderings. Okay.
It's in Wanderings.
Yeah, that's one I haven't read entirely.
Yeah.
I started it, and a lot of it seemed to be sort of repetitious, and I laid it aside. But I appreciate mm-hmm. Potok's writing very much. Mm-hmm. I've read most of it. That's one that I didn't complete.
Yeah.
Well, any other comments?
The thing that amazes me is that people could really, that Orthodox Jews, that someone like Paul, I mean, it had to be an experiential thing for him to accept this Jesus of Nazareth as Messiah, not fulfilling any of the anticipated behavior of a Messiah. That someone with as much orthodoxy and training, a student of Gamaliel, that he could accept Christ as this Jesus as the Christ or as Messiah, just blows your mind.
It took a revelation.
Yeah.
Bright light and a voice mm-hmm. on the Damascus Road.
Mm-hmm.
Or as he himself said, writes, a revelation of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
He was apprehended.
A lot of people who Jews today, though, don't come at it doctrinally, theologically. I just think of our first church in Elizabeth, New Jersey, where we were located in what would be probably called a Jewish ghetto or a Jewish neighborhood, with three synagogues within a block or two from us, and five, six kosher meat markets just nearby, around the street. Most everybody was Jewish in the area. Orthodox Jews want to live within a Sabbath day's walk of the synagogue and so on. And we had different people from the National Lutheran Council come from the division of the what was called the Christian Approach to the Jewish People. And as time went on, we were receiving more Jews into the congregation than we were Gentiles.
Mm.
And when I asked why they became Christians, you know, it was your comment about experiential. In every single case, it was never Lutheran theology, my good sermons, or this or this. But it was always an extraordinary act of love that one of our members' families had done for or toward their Jewish neighbor. And they said there was no reason in the world why they should have done this. Mm-hmm. But they did.
Mm-hmm.
And it started them thinking about maybe there is something to this love of Christ after all.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beginning of their walk towards Jesus as the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
And they're becoming members of our church. So your comment about experiential isn't quite the same as Paul's experience, but experience and the way we relate to Jewish folks means so much. I remember, some have said, well, should we try to convert Jews and all of this? And, you know, it's the Holy Spirit that converts, not us, but I think we need to be faithful in our witness in a non-pushy way, that grants the total freedom to the person to say no without any coercion. But I remember very well going, and I mentioned this in class when we were looking and studying this week, Justin Martyr's dialogue with Trifo. And Martyr, Justin, is a Christian, and Trifo is a Jewish person. I went into Chicago with this rabbi on the train just about every day. Just happened to go in the same time. We talked and talked and talked. And I wondered how to bring the claim of Jesus the Messiah to bear upon him and his life. And I felt it was just wrong to talk about the weather and this and that, and about religion and so forth, without somehow bringing the claim of Christ upon his life. And one day it just felt, now's the time. So I invited him to become a Christian, to receive Jesus as Messiah. And instead of being angry like I thought he might, and say, oh, that's why you've been my friend all these several years now, he rather looked at me with a big smile on his face, put his arm around my shoulder, and he said, thank you. He said, I've read the New Testament 4 times, and I've come to see that a Christian is one who wants to give the very best that he or she has to their friends, to people they meet. They want to witness. They want to point them to Christ. And your faith in Christ as Messiah is the most precious thing that you have. And I have come to see that's what a real Christian, what is expected of a real Christian, or something like that, you say. And now I know you truly are my friend, because you want to give me the very best that you have. That for which you would die, you want to share with me. And now I know you are my friend. You have not withheld the most precious possession that you have from me, but you have wanted to share it with me.
But he didn't convert.
But no, he said no, thank you.
No, thank you. Yeah.
But I've always thought of that reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And that he probably, this Jewish rabbi, had an insight into the essence of Christian faith and religion and what it means to witness than many other Christians have, who don't really care that much about
being a witness of Christ. But he understood what the essence of the Christian faith was.
And he's still close friends?
No, we have, after we left Chicago, we never have.
Yeah.
As I read some Christian, more, I suppose, of the more liberal persuasion or whatever, it's almost that they're apologetic vis-a-vis the Jews. Here we have the gospel. You have the Torah. You're God's people. We recognize this. It's called recognition theology. We'll not try proselytizing.
He was a conservative Jew, mm-hmm. not Reformed and not Orthodox.
Yeah.
And he told me, he said, for me, not everybody would agree with me, but for me, he said, the height of anti-Semitism is when Christians refuse to share the best that they have with a Jewish person.
Hmm.
That's the height of anti-Semitism.
Very
then they don't want to give him the best that they have. And I thought, boy, that's a strange. Because I've been in other dialogue groups with Jewish rabbis where they become very angry at the thought of anyone trying to witness or convert, you know.
Well, I think that's a good note on which to end.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
Mm-hmm.